supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Profit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, it was 6 years ago, writer and journalist Vicki Glembacki was single, dating, doing all the exciting things a single woman in her early 30s should be doing. And just a few years later, she was married to a lapsed Mormon and pregnant. When we meet her in the opening pages of her new book, The Second 9 Months, she's the brand new mother who was just delivered a baby girl. She's feeling something that she can't describe. It's either terror or bliss. At first, she thinks it's bliss. Later, it turns into terror and at times, desperation. We're going to be talking about motherhood today. What it's like in the beginning, what women do and do not talk about, and how it affects your identity and your relationships. If you want to join the conversation, please call us at 888-477-9499. I urge you to call early in the show. I have a feeling we're going to be backed up with calls. 888-477-9499. And the show is about the second 9 months, early motherhood, what it's like, what it's really like. Vicki Glembacki, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I will bet you never predicted your fast move from single career woman to married and then pregnant. So tell us about your early marriage, whether pregnancy was planned.
You know, I don't think it was either planned or not planned. I kind of knew in my grand scheme of life that I would get married and that I would then have a baby. So we got married and then a few years later moved to the burbs and got a house, and then all within the kind of plan that we were going to have children. And I think what was really true about it is that I never really thought there was going to be much of a transition. I kind of just thought, this is just natural. This is a progression that is very natural. And so when I was pregnant, I truly expected this to be a switch that was going to flip, and that I would become maternal after that, and it would be very natural.
So what was the pregnancy like for you?
Oh, the pregnancy, I loved being pregnant. Loved it. It was, I felt good when I was pregnant. I just enjoyed my body pregnant, which was an unusual feeling because so many women don't enjoy their bodies for their whole lives, but I really did enjoy myself. And my husband and I were excited and painting the nursery and reading every morning. On Saturday mornings, we would lay in bed and read from my pregnancy week by week and, you know, just talk about what's happening with the baby. And so it was exciting.
Did you have a vision of the baby and or of you as a mother?
I didn't have really a vision of the baby, but as a mother, I was going to be a good mother. Because I just believed I would know I would be good at this. Because I'm a person who, I'm good at things, and I work hard at stuff. And if I do what I know how to do, I know that I can be successful. And that is just the person that I am. So I completely expected to be, you know, immediately good at it. Immediately at ease.
Did you have an image of what that meant?
Being a good mother?
Yeah. I mean, you knew about being good, but good mother.
That's a good question. I think, you know, my image of that would be just this, you know, I think I bought the notion of my life is finally complete now. Now that I have this baby, my life is complete. I finally know my purpose. And, I say all those things with, you know, imaginary quotes in the air, because that's how people talk about motherhood, you know. I have this baby, and finally I now know my purpose in life.
You say you bought it, as though it's counterfeit.
I do believe that it is real. I don't believe it is immediately real. I thought quite literally that this was going to be an instinct, a gene was going to turn on, and I was going to do all the right things, know what to do, know how to handle it.
Where did you get that idea?
I think it's just the idea of motherhood in general, of moms in general. Women don't talk about when you're pregnant and people start to talk to you about like the warning signs of what's about to happen. You know, they'll give you enormous amounts of detail about their labor and delivery. So you kind of think that if you can make it through labor and delivery, you're good to go. And then they'll say you're going to be tired and you're going to not have time to shower. So, you know, I basically imagined myself being kind of, you know, stinky and sleepy, but sitting there holding this baby all stoned on maternal bliss and feeling all of those feelings, which are that's what you see on a baby story on TV. That's what you read in the books, even in movies. It's you never see the transition. And, you know, this book is a love story. So it's a growing of a relationship, but nobody talks about every relationship has to start somewhere. And my relationship with this baby had a place to start.
Where
did it start?
Yes. I mean, some mothers describe it starts at conception.
Yeah, they do. I did not feel connected to my child until maybe 7 months, when she was 7 months old. And what I think is that I'm not saying that that's common for everyone, but there is a process.
A colleague of mine many years ago, Dr. John Sonny, described a phenomenon called psychological adoption that mothers, parents go through, where there is a point where you adopt this child as your own psychologically. Hmm. And I don't know. You talk about a gene being turned on. Perhaps yours didn't get turned on. Perhaps it got turned on later. Perhaps everybody's gets turned on at a different time. But maybe that's the phenomenon of psychological adoption.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's just that there's no gene at all and no switch at all, and that it's just a process, and that you, as any relationship is, you just learn. You know, you learn how to navigate this time of your life and this new person and this new relationship.
You learn, don't you, imply that there's a finite period of learning. We talked before the show that my daughters are 34 and 33, and I'm still trying to figure it out, although by now I trust that they can handle most of it.
Well, I tell women that all the time. I say, we are always a new mother. We are a new mother. You know, my mother is a new mother right now, dealing with a daughter who has a new two children and a new book out. You know, we're always that way. And we have to allow women to be new mothers.
Yeah, and if you pretend you know what you don't know, it just takes the joy out of it.
Yeah, and I think we all do pretend. I think that's what a lot was happening with me and a lot of women. I can't tell you how many stories I hear of women who go to their friends' homes and who seem to have it all together, and the house is always picked up and the kids are always fed and everything, and they think, oh my God, how does she have it together and I don't? How does she have it together and I don't? But the thing is, a woman just told me the other day, she had that friend, she stopped over to her house unannounced one day, and the house was crazy and everything was nuts. And it's just, we show what we want to. And if we want to say, you know, I spent half of the second 9 months with my daughter telling everybody, I'm fine, we're fine, I'm fine. Oh, we're fine, it's great, I love it, we're fine, we're fine. Meanwhile, we weren't fine. You know, I wasn't fine.
Let's take a phone call, and then I'm going to get to how you really were and what happened after the baby came. Let's have Lauren join us on the air. Lauren?
Hi. Thanks so much for the show. I think it's really important.
Thank you.
I am 31 years old. I have two girls, one of whom is 5, one of whom is 1.5. And it really took me this 4 years to finally feel like being a mother is really part of who I am and adjust to this part of my identity. And, you know, the first 2 years was adjusting to the kids, and the second 2 years was you know, learning that I have to be in this equation too. And, you know, it's great for me to give everything to these girls and my husband. And then all of a sudden I'm freaking out at everybody because I haven't had any time for myself. And I think that women tend to do that to ourselves. We tend to try and give as much as we can. And then particularly mothers, we're sort of left hanging in the wind, and it's not really good for anybody.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you should say that. I kind of am in a similar place that you are, because I have a 3-year-old and I'm just kind of in a 1-year-old, and I had a second baby, which none of my friends can believe, but I'm just getting at that point where I can start to see myself again. But I think all the time, you know, we were told growing up, you can do anything. Women can do anything, and you can do everything, and you really do believe it. So then you have these kids, and you believe that you can bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan and take care of the kids and do all of the stuff, and you do lose yourself. I mean, I believe in those second 9 months, I'm just now starting to kind of come to a balance place with who I am as a mother.
I would like to hear you both talk about Lauren and Vicky, because Lauren, you implied something about identity. So the question is, and I'll start with you, Lauren, who were you? Who were you before you got to this place? Who have you been over these last several years? We don't have her.
Too busy to think about it. I was, you know, I was trying to get my house together, and I was trying to make sure my daughter was completely taken care of, and I was, you know, I'm the youngest in my family, so I was always terrified that I didn't know what I was doing, that I, you know, wasn't qualified to do this. And, you know, after I kind of got my hand around this job, and I really felt good at it, and I still do, I feel like I'm a great mom, I realized I wanted to be more than that. And there's, you know, it's going to be better for everybody if I'm more than just a great mom. I have to be, like, a good me. And so I've been, you know, I've been kind of writing now and just doing things for myself, and everybody's much happier.
Well, Lauren, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you so much.
So tell us about your identity, Vicky.
Well, what I felt, I kind of alluded to it earlier, but when I was moving in, you know, the day before, you know, here we are, a transition that is yesterday, no baby, today, baby. So this is a big change. And on yesterday, no baby, I was a woman who, I was very confident. I was very successful. I was believed that, you know, there was nothing I couldn't do. I really did believe that. And that I was good at things that I tried. And then the next day, today, baby, after that, I could not find that woman. I felt like I was doing everything wrong. I couldn't get my baby to stop crying. I couldn't get her to nurse. I couldn't get her to sleep. And what the identity shift for me was that I could no longer even glimpse that woman. I thought, where has she gone? And worse, you know, is she ever going to come back? I mean, I thought I'd be sitting there for the rest of my life on this couch with this ponytail in my head, with this baby, trying to nurse her. I mean, for the rest of my life. I really believed the time had stopped, and that I was never going to be the person that I was again, because I had hit the biggest challenge and I didn't succeed.
Well, we all do that, don't we? When we're in crisis, we think this moment is the moment,
yeah,
and I'll never change. But you remind me of an attorney I spoke with who was a new mom, and she said she realized that the change for her was when she was working, it was all about outcome, that she had a job to do. She finished the job. She closed the file, and then it was done.
Mm-hmm.
And then she'd move on to the next job, and she said, being a new mom, it's never done.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's all about process. And she said that was the transition she struggled with, because that's why she felt like a failure, because she never had the sense that the file was closed. It was done. She could start again tomorrow.
I totally can relate to that. And also just the idea of the to-do list and having goals and being able to accomplish something. I spent so much time in the early days nursing her and checking my email with the other hand, even though I was on maternity leave and nobody at work cared and was expecting to hear from me, but I just wanted the feeling of accomplishing something, of so that I could answer an email or do anything to feel value. I wanted to feel valuable because I felt like what I was doing here, I was failing. So I needed any sign I could get. I even went to the laundromat and I washed clothes or washed sheets and stuff just so that I could cross something off and say that I had accomplished something.
I just want to comment on your body language when you talk about your email. You are reaching out with your right hand as though you were reaching out. You're trying to grasp something
truly
that you had.
Truly, it was very much like that, and you know I was trying to find myself. I really was. I didn't recognize who I was. I wasn't a person who failed.
We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back to you in just a little while when we come out of our. And I do want to hear about the babies and what that was like. But when we come out of our break, we're going to hear from Meg Wolitzer, who wrote a wonderful novel called The 10-Year Nap, and it's about what happens to three mothers, I think, in their 40s. After professional moms who have babies. So we'll come back. We'll hear from Meg. We'll hear later from Vicki about her babies, and we're going to take your phone calls. Our lines are all lit up. So if it's busy, that's why, because everybody wants to join this particular conversation. We've been listening to Vicki Glimbacki. She's a writer for Philadelphia Magazine. She's the author of The Second 9 Months. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2. 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Democracy is all about choosing. Our nation is built on the individual choices of the nearly 125 million Americans who vote. WHYY helps you make an informed choice. We cover the issues, the events, the speeches, and the debates. We have a Why Decide blog online to offer a youth perspective on the election. Call 1-888-345-9499 right now and make your financial contribution and get all the benefits of the WHYY experience.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about motherhood today, specifically new motherhood. Joining us now by phone is Meg Wolitzer. Her new book is called The 10-Year Nap. Meg, welcome to Voices.
Oh, thanks so much.
So your novel focuses on four women in their 40s who opt out of their careers to become stay-at-home moms. And obviously, this has been called the opt-out generation. This is well-educated women who quit their jobs after having children. Mm-hmm. Why do you think this is happening? What's your take on this?
It's sort of complicated, I think. You know, I grew up with a mother who was a feminist and who told me, you can do anything you want. And it never occurred to me that that wasn't true, and that it never occurred to me that everyone wouldn't find a passion, a job that they absolutely loved. I did find one that I absolutely loved, and I've been doing it really, you know, ever since I was young. But I don't think that that's true necessarily for everyone. One's passion isn't necessarily an office-based passion, a work-based passion. This is something that's sort of hard to reckon with. But I think that I got to know a lot of women who, after their kids were born, when they thought about going back to work, they thought, now it's time, this is the way I'd always planned it. Suddenly, the idea of going back to, say, a corporate job that didn't love them the way their baby did, that didn't make them feel the way their baby did, suddenly had less of a pull. And that is not the story for everyone, but it is the story for some women who I met.
Well, I have a generational question about mm-hmm. this, because the early feminists, and we heard it, you know, from that one comment Hillary Clinton made, 18 years ago about baking cookies that mm-hmm. she got in so much trouble for. The early feminists, you know, the implication, the message was that if you don't go out and have your career, then there's something shameful about that. There's something wrong. But your generation's not getting that message, or is it?
Well, it is. It's getting mixed messages, and it's giving mixed messages. I mean, when I wrote the 10-year nap, it was really because I had not seen anything about this topic that simply tried to show what it was like. On the one hand, I'd seen books, and we've all seen these books, nonfiction books, that take a strong position. Should you work? Should you not? What are the implications if you do? What if you don't? Things that seemed sometimes like extended magazine articles that told women how to live. On the other hand, I would see novels that were more like, I guess, you know, chick lit books, like books with a picture of a stork carrying a briefcase or something on the cover, that dealt with these issues. And everyone was portrayed in a somewhat cartoonish way. There was the mother who is oversubscribed as a mother, whose kids take Krav Maga classes and paper-making classes, and she's kind of a cartoonish figure. And then there's the executive who never sees her children. And none of it seemed fair to women. None of it seemed to just show what is it like. So I decided that I wanted to write a novel about it because I hadn't seen it done, and I wanted to know, what is it really like? I mean, what is it like if you've been someone who's always had ambition because you grew up smart and well-educated, and maybe your mother told you you can do what you want, but what happens if, after your babies are born, something's changed a little bit in you? Why should you feel you must work? If you can afford not to, why must you?
Well, that's the other part of the argument, and I'm sure you've heard it 1,000 times, that this whole dilemma is a struggle of privilege, and how many middle class and lower middle class women would love to have that struggle.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't. It is in that a very narrow band of the population can afford to say work is really primarily about fulfillment. Work for most people all across America is about money, is about putting food on your table, feeding your kids, clothing your kids. That's absolutely true. And yet, I think that, and I set my novel, The 10-Year Nap, in New York City because it was a place in which these things do play out more openly and frequently. But what I also found to be true is talking to women not just from affluent areas, there's a way in which motherhood shakes things up a bit so that one's relationship to work might change. I mean, even people who need to work, want to work, for whom it's not an option not to, start to think, is there a way to do it so that things don't have to be shortchanged all the time?
How so?
Well, can you go back part-time? Can you work from home? How can you be there between those hours that I consider? I mean, I want to write a novel called 3 to 6, which is that time of day when, you know, the workday doesn't end for most people until long after school ends. But there's that kind of magic time that I know a lot of mothers and fathers, too, would love to be there with their kids. You know, it's almost like the kids have been given truth serum after school ends, and they will suddenly expound about things that happened and won't shut down and might tell you things about what happened during the day, and you can have this kind of beautiful time with them. That is denied to people who work in conventional jobs with conventional hours, where they basically want you there all the time and want you to be thinking about the job all the time.
Tell us what it was like for you those first 6 months that Vicki talks about in her book.
I was an anxious mother. I was very excited about motherhood, but I didn't know really what to expect. I was one of the first friends among my group of friends to have a baby. I felt that other people knew how to do it better than I did. I didn't know why I thought this, as though they'd been given a secret handbook that I hadn't been given. I remember going to a playgroup with my son when he was a little bit older than that, when he was just starting to walk, around a year old. And he was the one kid who didn't grab the maracas. You know, he was the one who ran down the hall into the bedroom of this strange apartment where we were. And I had to keep, you know, with my face hot and flushed, run after my child. And he threw himself down on the bed in this apartment, and where all the coats were, and I threw myself down beside him, and I was kind of relieved to be out of there in a way. We were the nonconformists. My son was doing this, but I think that I found that, you know, with my second child, of course, I was much calmer. You're kind of throwing the child over your shoulder like a sort of sack of laundry, and not thinking twice about how you do things. to second guess yourself in early motherhood is painful. It's a painful kind of thing. I put some of that experience into the 10-year nap, but not only that, but also I think what I considered the profundity of being at home with children, the kind of living Mary Cassatt painting that you can get in your life in the early days of motherhood. It's a powerful thing. And yet the world of work and the world of sort of big male experience is taken as seriously in fiction. But what happens between women and children in the quiet hours when no one else is looking has been seen as something less important. And I don't think that that's true.
Meg, let's take a call, see if we could bring a caller in and bring Vicki back in, sure, into the discussion. We've got Jana on the line.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm sorry, I can't hear you very well.
Well,
I'm going to try to turn off my radio, maybe?
Yeah, that helps.
Okay. What your guest is saying is everything I'm kind of feeling, actually. My son is going to be a year next week, and I've been home with him for the most part. I teach part-time at a community college, but what seemed to be perfect a few months ago in terms of having most of my time with him and just a couple hours away a week is now becoming kind of crazy for me. I feel very isolated as he gets older and he's more into a routine, and I have friends who are mothers who are also kind of home for the most part with their kids for this first year, but I feel very much like I don't have anybody to talk to all day. My husband's at work, he's busy, everybody has these things that they're doing and they're very busy, and I feel very much like I'm home alone with baby and no one to talk to. And that's one of the things that I feel like I'm, you know, living the feminine mystique a little bit, which even though I work part-time, I still feel very much like I'm alone with the baby all the time.
Yeah, I've got a wild guess here that maybe you're not alone. So let's hear what our guests have to say. Thanks for calling in, Jenna.
I would say I know that feeling really, really well. There is a painful isolation. You know, to some extent, you can get rid of it through groups of mothers. But in other ways, sometimes, at least in my own experience, it amplified it a little bit. But there's nothing wrong with feeling that for a little bit, knowing that you're going to survive it and come through it. I found that experience, when I think back on it now, because the thing is, this period in your life is so brief. It really is brief. The world will return. Everything will return just as you left it. That's what I found. If you can kind of experience it now, even in the painful parts, it will be very brief, and you'll miss it.
Let me turn to you, Vicki, and bring you back into the conversation. What about the other side of what Meg is saying and what Jana might be saying is that maybe that sense of isolation is a calling. Maybe a year and a half is okay for the baby and for you, and maybe this is whatever internal calling works for you. Maybe it's time for you to get back.
You have to really pay attention to, you know, what's going on with you. But I think what's interesting is, you know, Meg and I both, we have been through this twice. You know, I have a second child, and I knew the second time around and during the second 9 months that my life would come back and that I would be back again. But Jana, who has a 1-year-old, you know, we can say to her, your life is going to come back. We can say to her, things are going to come back to normal. We can tell her all of those things because we've heard them a million times. But when you are sitting in the middle of it with a 1-year-old who's crying in the background, you know, you really don't know that you're going to come back.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Well, but I'm also hearing another issue here. I'm not hearing necessarily a baby crying in the background, although we literally did hear a baby crying in the background. But, you know, what about the moms, the new moms, who have raised their child for a year and a half and now are starting to feel lonely for adult connections and a longing to get back in the workplace?
It's a very natural feeling. I mean, I think that it's a natural feeling to want to talk, to have conversations that don't include the phrase sippy cup, you know, that you want to get back into the world. I would say one way you can sort of start doing it is by going back to reading. I mean, I think that that's reading the paper, reading a wonderful novel, reading Middlemarch, whatever it is that makes you feel like you have a life that actually isn't only about your baby, that you have an interior life. And I think if you start with the interior life, the exterior life can come soon.
Meg, you make some pretty elegant observations in your book about identities, and I'd like to hear you address that. You say they come from and go from being independent woman to frightened mother, etc., but they don't come and go easily. Tell us about this, when, how you learned this.
I think that really all phases like this, I mean, are change of it. I mean, you as a therapist would know how hard one change can be, really. And I think that for, you know, when you suddenly take what is, for a lot of married couples, you know, a kind of a period of early bliss in, you know, or love together and being together and forming that little world, when you open it up to include a child, it's a shock. It's like a slap. It can really feel different than you'd imagined it. And to then say, after sort of living in that and doing what is required of you, which in the beginning is sometimes feels like small animal care, and you think to yourself, but wait, I went to Brown, or I'm a lawyer, or whatever it is, and none of those skills are being asked of you right now. That could almost be like an insult, too. But there is something about pulling back, really. If you can ever write a note to yourself and sort of put it on the wall above your table that says, this too shall pass, and one day you'll miss that. I mean, I really miss these phases that I've gone through. It's kind of like a slideshow when I look at my life. The characters in The 10-Year Nap, each of them has a story. Each of them has a past that I go into, really, because they're characters in a novel, so I'm allowed the kind of depth of observation that you're not allowed sometimes in, you know, in a polemic or in a magazine article. I wanted to show how people change. You know, for me, The 10-Year Nap is not just about having children. It's about the middle of life. This experience, this profound experience of having babies and having them grow a little older, happens near the middle of one's life often. And I think that it's got an existential dimension. We're thinking about change, not only about being a mother, but getting older, and that's really hard too.
I was thinking just that, Meg, when you commented about me as a therapist and knowing how difficult it is to switch identities. My reaction to that comment was not as a therapist, but mm-hmm. as a reaction of a 60-plus-year-old man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that as I age on a personal level, that identity, the whole issue of identity, becomes less important and less relevant. And who am I when people ask? I don't know. Who wants to know?
There's something so really quite beautiful and tender to me about young women, you know, feeling these anxieties and concerns, because that to me is about the sort of flush of youth in a way, because it feels a little bit out of your control in that way, because it's the chaos of life all around you. And that's what young motherhood is about. And later on, when the chaos settles down, that's when I think women start to look in the mirror and waking, you know, they're waking up
right.
from what I call in my novel, The 10-Year Nap.
Right, when the dust settles. Well, we've got to go to break. Meg, I want to thank you so much for joining us. The book was just wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much.
Meg Wolitzer is author of The 10-Year Nap. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be back talking with Vicki Glambacki. She's a writer for Philadelphia Magazine, author of The Second 9 Months. We're going to talk about what the baby was like early on and how Vicki's life changed. I also want to hear, Vic, about your marriage mm-hmm. and what impact this has all had on your marriage. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actor Kyle Chandler, who's gearing up for the third season of the highly acclaimed TV show Friday Night Lights. Chandler also will talk about his explosive guest role on Grey's Anatomy. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day. Code Inspector Jose Mendez is on the front lines of the housing crisis.
That one's owned by the bank. That one's owned by the bank. All of these here are owned by the bank.
His job, keeping intruders out of the abandoned homes in his community.
You have clothes. Usually you'll find a mattress. Sometimes you'll even find them sleeping in here.
Confronting the myriad frustrations of home foreclosure.
So we board and secure these houses, and then what?
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. I'm here with Vicki Glambacki. She's a writer for Philly Mag and the author of The Second 9 Months. One of your chapters is called I Am Wrong, I Am Invisible, I Am Mother. I love that chapter, and I love that chapter title. So, talk. Why did you write that?
Well, early on, I had my daughter, her name is Blair. She was a tough baby. She was colicky, and well, I decided she was colicky because she wouldn't stop crying at all. For 5 months, I mean, it was a very long period of time, and I, like I've said, there was nothing I could do, and I couldn't stop it, and whatever. And then here we kind of were this perfect storm of a child who was difficult and a woman who was incredibly self-analytical and looking at that saying, you know, why can't I fix this? What is wrong with me? You know, and I kind of wanted the doctor to say that she had colic just so I had a word, just some kind of word. I also wanted somebody to tell me I had postpartum depression for the same reason. I just wanted a word to be able to tell people, this is why I'm acting this way, feeling this way.
You never got a word?
No.
So the words you used were invisible, incompetent, those kind of words about
yourself?
Yeah,
I mean, I had a lot of it was kind of what Meg was talking about, and she said, you know, you need to get out and see other moms. And until I started meeting other women, and like she said, that is a double-edged sword because you do end up looking at how great their kids are and how they seem to be handling it so well, and you feel they have the manual and you don't. I can so relate to that feeling. I feel that today, you know. But I was feeling so just completely out of my own skin. I didn't recognize myself. And it's not that I was invisible to my husband or I was invisible to my child. I was invisible to myself. I was wrong to myself. It felt to me that I had lost touch with myself entirely in practical ways, because I couldn't solve these problems like nursing and, you know, sleeping, basic functioning of a child. I was just completely not prepared for how hard that was.
So you were busy trying to figure out how you can be who you were.
Mm-hmm. Holding on to who I was, trying to mesh the two together, realizing that there was no way that was going to happen for real, so pretending that it was okay. So the woman, you know, I'm a problem solver. I can do this. I kept convincing myself that there was an answer that I could feel with the baby, that I could succeed with this baby.
I remember one of my students when she was graduating my family therapy course many years ago. She cried and she said, I feel like I am being, she said, I feel like my childhood when I am being asked to do something I don't know yet how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And that's just what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being asked to do something I don't know how to do, and you have to do it no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, there is a real feeling when you joke and say, oh, I wish I could just, you know, send the baby back. But then, you know, women say that and then they laugh afterwards. Haha, I'm just kidding. But there, many women are really thinking,
well,
you know, how do I, how can I,
how am I going to make this?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same way that middle-aged men joke about impotence and old people joke about death. It's
right.
A half a joke.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Your book was excerpted in Salon.com, and there you told a story how when the baby was 2 weeks old, you took her for a walk, and for a change, she couldn't stop crying. You didn't know what to do because you had your bed linens in the laundromat, which I think were a couple blocks away, and you felt like you were losing your mind, so you called your husband. So what surprised me about the excerpt were the reactions, and I want to read one. It goes, "Ugh, yeah, lady, you should be on that train. Get a job and a nanny and get on with dealing with real problems instead of some sort of high-strung drama about bedspreads and dryers. Thad probably thinks less of you for making wet bedspreads into an effing crisis while he's at a real job solving real, more meaningful problems. Mm-hmm. Women like this turn me into a female misogynist." So she had some pretty strong feelings.
Ouch. That when people say, for anybody to say, go deal with real problems, doesn't understand real problems. I mean, that is, I would have actually been grateful to get on the train and go to my office and solve those meaningless problems at work than to be sitting there dealing with a human life. You know, that I would have been happy to do that. And that's basically what the excerpt says. But people are very uncomfortable when you admit, that this Meg said it perfectly, that it's not a Mary Cassatt painting. It's perfect.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Fiona. Fiona, do we have you?
Hi, how are you doing? Good afternoon. Enjoying the show.
Thank you. Me too.
I'm absolutely loving the commentary, and I feel like I'm getting a play-by-play back of my first child. And I'm absolutely curious, because I went through the same complete loss of identity. I had a very professional career. I traveled all over the world, you know, doing my consulting job. And then suddenly I was housebound with this child, also with colic. And I had no idea how I was supposed to cope with it. I had the same mental lists. I had my to-do list and everything. You'd try and get something checked off, and invariably you never got the list done. But I'm curious as to how much this is a phenomenon of A-type personalities versus B-type personalities. Hmm. The B-type personality women cope with this better than the very driven A-type. I often wonder that maybe if I was an A-type, I might have handled it better. With a second child, I dealt with it, but with the first one, I there was this loss of self. But why can't I achieve this? Why aren't I getting this done?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm sure that's not the answer, but I'm sure that comes into play that, you know, people who are high-achieving, focused, intelligent, have this very clear, if not narrow, definition of who they are, how they fit in the world, and how the world works. They're the ones that are going to get into trouble no matter what. No matter what changes befall them, they're the ones that are going to get into trouble, as opposed to someone who's has a softer relationship with themselves and their external world. Interesting take. Thank you, Fiona.
I also think there's more, in addition to that, there's, I'm part of this generation of women who, we all had careers, we had our children later, we do not live near our families with our aunts down the street and our moms around the corner. You know, I had a complete and total identity. As a career person, and you know, that's a different, you know, in addition to being like the type A person, and I'm also, you know, I wonder if I would have had my daughter when I was 25 before I had a sense of the other side of the spectrum, I might not have struggled as much because I wouldn't have developed such a strong take of a career woman. I wouldn't have known that person so well. You know, the woman that I was, the problem solver, the driven, ambitious. I wouldn't have gotten to that point yet, maybe.
Yeah, one doesn't know. It could have been easier.
Yeah, could have, would have, should have, right.
Could have been easier, could have been harder. So, Vicki, can we talk about sex? I love that nervous laughter. Well, generally, it doesn't happen shortly after a baby is born, and generally it doesn't happen for a long time after a baby is born. And often she feels guilty or resentful of his desires. How did you guys navigate that?
Yeah, well, it's a funny story. So many of my friends, you have a 6-week appointment after you have a baby, and the OBGYN checks you out, and then the OBGYN says, hey, you're good to go, you can do whatever. And inevitably, every one of my friends goes home, and we went home and said to our husbands, oh, the doctor said 2 more weeks, at least 2 more weeks. You know, yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on there that I was not ready for. And in talking about the identity, I mean, any desire is gone. And you also have just come off of having, you know, 30 extra pounds on your body. You just had you haven't been feeling good about yourself for a long time. And then not only are you looking at yourself and not recognizing yourself, but you're looking in the mirror and you do not recognize who you see there. Your body is completely someone else's body. I always say it's like I suddenly became my mom. Like, there I was. And it was so hard for me to want to have sex or to think about it. Plus, my body had been repurposed. I mean, and all women feel that way. My breasts, these are for feeding babies. This area down here is for pushing babies out of my body. You know, this is not, my body is a machine that exists for this child at this moment, you know. And the last thing you want when you're nursing a baby is somebody else to be touching, pawing anywhere near you. I mean, I say you as if it's everyone. It was very much me. And I know other women have felt that way, but it took so long. I mean, even now, my second daughter is 11 months old, and my husband and I just only recently got to a point where I was kind of starting to be able to see myself as a sexual person again that didn't have to do with sex equaling babies. Oh, and also the other issue, I'm sorry, but the other issue is in the early days and during the second 9 months, when you have a child that's very hard, you're not going to do anything that could possibly get you another child. You know, I remember thinking, I'm not going to risk this. I do not want another one. I don't want to have to deal with this.
So I think you've been pretty clear about about your feeling.
You think?
I think. So let's come back to the relationship. Did you feel okay about not having sex? Did he feel okay? Were you as eloquent with him then as you were with us now?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I wouldn't think.
I couldn't see anything at that time. I don't think I don't think he's even had this conversation with me. You and I are probably talking about it more in depth. I mean, what I wasn't willing to accept, I wasn't able to accept, and I get to it in the book toward the end when I finally realize my husband, not only was he, you know, going to the gym after work and, you know, doing things. And I was so angry with him and feeling like he wasn't helping enough and whatever. And it wasn't until much later, 8 months in, that I realized, wait a minute. He was going through an identity crisis of his own, too. He was holding on to his old life as well. He was trying to, you know, be the guy that he was. And I wasn't willing to give that to him. I'm not even sure I'm entirely willing to give it to him now, only because I know my life changed more than his. I mean, this is such a process, and marriage with kids is a forever process.
Yeah, and you know, I'll talk about a father, talk about invisible, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, everybody says, how's the baby, and how's the mother, and by the way, will you pick that up over there?
So. And he was very invisible to me, too. I mean, I could not see, I couldn't see myself, I couldn't see him, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't even see the baby. I mean, it was tough, and it is still tough. I mean, it is a process.
So we've got about 3 minutes left, 2.5 minutes left. So I have to say to Christina, Grace, Ruth, Meredith, and Amy that I'm sorry we can't get to your calls, because I do want a perspective here, and I want to know when things got better in your marriage, in your life, your identity? Just tell us about how you are and how you got there.
I think toward the end of the second 9 months, literally, I mean, there's a very much of a truth to the time period of the book, is that that was at the point where I started to accept my relationship and accept who I was for my daughter and accept my new nuclear family. I mean, I was accepting that I was no longer the daughter of two parents, but I was now the mother of a daughter.
Did it involve loss?
Did it involve loss? Yeah. I mean, loss of letting go? Yeah, it did. It did involve letting go. And letting go of control, letting go of my own control over and needing to do that and needing to have all the answers all the time. I mean, that's the one thing I've come to place with, is that I'm okay with the fact that this is a process. I cannot control it. I cannot know the moment that the baby is born exactly what I'm supposed to do, which is what I thought was true. As far as the relationship is concerned, like I said earlier, I mean, I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, and I am saying my husband and I, particularly in the past, I've been telling people within the past month, you know, I think we are finally seeing each other again. And it's taken all of that time for us to do that.
Since the first baby was born.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been years. Not that there hasn't been, but I think he and I are both feeling more comfortable with our children and who we are as a family. And I think that helps when we recognize that we're both dealing with the transition. I'm not trying to own it all. He's not trying to own it all. And we're absolutely communicating about it better. I mean, as in just recently. Hmm. And that's, you know.
Well, I have to say I'm happy for both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
And I also have to say thank you so much.
Yeah, this was lovely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was lovely. And I have to say one other thing, Vicki. I promised I wouldn't. Happy birthday.
Oh!
I'm not going to give the number because I'm afraid you'll hurt me. But happy birthday.
Thank you.
My guests today have been Vicki Glumbacki and Mel Wolitzer. Glumbacki is the author of The Second 9 Months. Wolitzer is the author of The 10-Year Nap. Both great books. Well, if you want to reach us here at the show, we're at voices@whyy.org, and you can find archived editions of the show there also. If you want to reach me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Our intern is Amanda Reyes. Gita Simons helped produce the show. Our associate producer is Elisa Walters. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Day to day.